Welcome. Thank you, everyone. Before I introduce our panelists for Watchdog, the Role of the Journalist in a Democracy, I just wanted to say a few words. This panel is actually the first panel that's sponsored by the Boston Literary District. My name is Alicia Abbott. I'm the director of the Boston Literary District. We were established in 2014, the very first cultural district in the country that's devoted just to literary arts. And we are our mission is to work collaboratively with writers and nonprofits to produce programming that raises the profile of Boston as a literary destination. And I'm very pleased to be here today. And I'm very pleased, especially to introduce our panelists. And also, just to let you know, we're going to be talking here, and then in the last 20 minutes, we're going to have questions from the audience. So we're not going to have any questions before then, but if you think of any questions you want to ask, we'll get to you. And then following the reading, we are going to have a book signing downstairs on the first floor of the books of Dick Lehr and Mitch Zukov. So first, Dick Lehr, while a reporter for nearly two decades at the Boston Globe, won numerous regional and national awards and was a 1997 Pulitzer Prize finalist as a member of the Boston Globe Spotlight team for its series, The Disability Disaster, an expose of abuse of disability benefits by retired public employees, which prompted reform of the Massachusetts pension system. He's also the author of The Fence, a police cover-up along Boston's racial divide, a nonfiction narrative about the worst-known case of police brutality in Boston, which was an Edgar Award finalist for Best Nonfiction. And he's the co-author of the New York Times bestseller and Edgar Award winner, Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and A Devil's Deal, and its sequel, Whitey, The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss. His most recent book is The Birth of a Nation, How a Legendary Filmmaker and a Crusading Editor Reignited America's Civil War. I'm also pleased to welcome with him Mitch Zukov, who's a former special projects reporter at the Boston Globe, where he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for investigative reporting. He also received the Distinguished Writing Award from the American Society of Newspaper Editors, the Livingston Award for International Reporting, and the Haywood Brown Award, and the Associated Press Managing Editors Public Service Award. He is also the author of seven books, most recently 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi, and the New York Times bestseller Lost in Shangri-La, which was a winner of the Winship Penn New England Award. With Dick Lehr, he is the co-author of Judgment Ridge, The True Story Behind the Dartmouth Murders, which was a finalist for the Edgar Award. And I'm very pleased to have both Mitch and Dick here today. So the topic for today is Watchdog, the Role of the Journalist in a Democracy. A lot of us are familiar with the idea of the press being the fourth estate. And that is its vital role keeping the other branches of government in check. Because without a free press, there's no public sphere, no informed citizen, and therefore no democracy. But this idea of the fourth estate is important both on a national level with the election, which we'll be talking a little bit about today, but also on a local level, keeping in check the justice system. The role of the journalist as watchdog is invaluable. That being said, we're in a time where a lot of newspapers across the country are shuttering or budgets for investigative teams are shrinking. So how do we preserve this function? And so I'm here glad to introduce Nick and Mitchell. And so first, I just wanted to talk you guys about, you know, the role of the investigative journalist today. There's less money, but there's a much more powerful engine. So for example, taking a look at your work with the Spotlight team on police lying and police behavior, I wonder if you could talk to us about the Testa lying scandals.
Yeah, sure. What Alicia's referring to is back in the mid, late 90s, as members of the Spotlight team, we spent nearly a year examining the Boston Police Department. And the culture of what we described as the culture of lying and cover-up. I mean, themes that echo, obviously, into this century for sure. And I think it was a series that illuminated this culture of cover-up and lying, and we targeted a whole bunch of officers who were involved in shaking down drug dealers, stealing their money and their drugs and covering it up. And then when they, you know, other officers saw the wrongdoing, they were reluctant to speak up because you never, you know, speak ill of a fellow officer, even if they're engaged in wrongdoing. And that led to, you know, much after the series ran, you know, the police commissioner, the mayor, and a whole bunch of people stood up and talked about, you know, this is the kind of thing that has to stop, and we need, and they, you know, the court system talked about, announced much ballyhooed reforms in a way to root out this kind of culture and improve checks and balances and whatnot. But, and so that was all great, you know, all fine and wonderful in terms of the Globe Spotlight team sort of playing its role as a local watchdog. But you have to stay on it. And that's one of the lessons that, you know, we've certainly learned and we try to pass along to our students, is because 6 or 7 or 8 years later, both Mitch and I now teach journalism at Boston University. And with a team of students who were engaged, you know, we had an investigative reporting clinic, we decided to say, hey, whatever happened to those reforms that would track an officer who's caught lying and somehow try to monitor that kind of conduct, and someone who's caught lying, they were supposed to be penalized in a certain way. So this team of students went out trying to get the data and the information and came back, you know, after, we kept pushing them, like, why aren't you coming up with anything? And then it turned out to be, there's nothing to come up with. Nothing ever happened. There was no new system in place. They interviewed the DA, they interviewed the head of the court system. It was just a handful of headlines after an expose that revealed this problem. So that was a real takeaway. You have to have a continuing role as a watchdog, you know, I think, in our society.
And I just wondered as well, you know, about the challenges you have when you are doing this kind of investigative work with the police departments, and you're being critical of them, yet you also need their cooperation. And you also have a system where, you know, the police are going to rely on community members to be able to testify honestly. And if they're not trusting in the credibility and the honesty of the police to protect them, you know, that there's this sort of domino effect. So I'm just sort of wondering how, you know, your work as investigative reporters, like how that affects your relationship with the community and the police.
Sure. Well, I guess I want to roll back just
yes,
a second.
Please.
You know, there are two kinds of stories in journalism. There's the story that 90% of stories that you see on TV and radio and newspapers, magazines, are stories that the subjects want to have told. Their profiles, their, you know, their positive stories, their stories about this cool event happening or this. And then there's the 10% that people don't want you to tell. The stories that the subjects are going to come after you or are not going to cooperate with you or are going to, you know, turn into a potentially hostile relationship. So the 90% is what fills up, and those are fairly easy to do relatively because you have PR people, you have people wanting to tell their story. The really hard stuff is this, and, you know, we're lucky if it's 10% of stories where there is a potentially adversarial relationship between the journalist and the subject. And so navigating that, especially for a police department where, you know, when you're at the Globe, you have an ongoing daily relationship between journalists and police officers and telling the stories sometimes they want told and sometimes the stories they don't want told. I don't want to oversimplify, but our attitude always at the Spotlight team was, and frankly, beyond that, you know, every good reporter is an investigative reporter. You don't have to be on the Spotlight team to be an investigative reporter. The attitude is, I don't work for them.
Yeah.
We don't really worry that much about what the police think of us or about the political officials or anybody else. We work for our audience. We work for our community. And so if we were to spend too much time worrying about our relationship, we'd never do anything. Because you can always talk yourself out of doing a Spotlight piece. You can always talk yourself out of doing a watchdog piece of journalism because there's going to be hell to pay. You're going to potentially face a libel suit. You're going to potentially face protests. Or you're going to have your editor called and said, you know, that guy Lair, he's been out to get me for 10 years.
Right.
Or that, you know. And it's, you know, it's the harder work. And yet, of course, it's the most important work. We would argue that there is in journalism. Because, let's face it, we're at a moment in time, and we're going to talk about the election later, maybe.
But, I guess we're getting there now.
How can we not talk about it?
I'm jumping ahead. I'm bearing... sorry, I know.
I know.
Have you heard there's an election coming up?
Yeah.
Where there has been... and this even goes beyond the election. There has been a concerted effort on a number of people's part and across the spectrum to undermine journalism.
To discredit
and to discredit the journalists and to turn them into the foil for their attacks and to question the credibility of every journalist there is. And that is the most one of several dangerous trends I think we're seeing at this current moment in time.
Yeah, I'm so tempted just to launch right into that. But,
sorry.
But I just want,
I jumped the line.
I know, we will, but I did want to just talk a little bit about the role of the journalist, not only in exposing police corruption, but also in exonerating, you know, people wrongly accused, especially in communities of color.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to refer to, like in 2003, Dick, your investigation into the 1989 conviction of Sean Drumgold for the murder of a 12-year-old Roxbury girl, which led to his release from a sentence of life without parole. You uncovered a pattern of police witness intimidation and new alibi evidence, and eventually the Suffolk County District Attorney asked the courts to release him in the interests of justice, which is, you know, really just incredible, because if you hadn't done that investigation, you know, what might have happened to him? But I guess I wanted to throw to you, you know, that, like, this work that you are doing, you know, it predates even the Black Lives Movement today, and how much the environment has changed in terms of a lot of people in communities sort of reporting their own stories in live time, you know,
right,
with their cell phones, and how, you know, your work sort of dovetails with that work, and if you could.
Yeah, well, I think one of the lessons, or one of the things that has come out of that kind of work in the Sean Drumgold case, and also in the Spotlight series on the Boston Police Department, and you mentioned it, Alicia, that, you know, this issue of trust between the police and the community, which is certainly, you know, visual on the captured videos that we've seen so much of, the great divide, the huge gap in trust. And that's a real problem. It was a problem then. It's certainly a problem now. And one of the things that I think about, and I don't know if even, you know, the Globe, the press today deals enough with it, is that on the one hand, when there's crime and violence in our neighborhoods, we'll hear from the police department how we need the civilians to help us. I mean, that's a legitimate request and a legitimate plea. We're all in this together. We need your help in solving this. People have to be willing to come forward and speak up and share what they know about this horrible crime to solve. But the part they don't get at, and I hope it's changing, but the part they don't get at is that for that to happen, the community has to trust the police. And in the kind of stories that I did for a whole bunch of years, when I reported in the community and interviewed the people who had been intimidated and berated by police to lie in the Sean Drumgold trial, there's great mistrust in the community. And they're feeling, and again, I'm just, you know, reflecting and echoing what I would hear in the community. Why should we stand up and help this police agency when I've seen them lie? I've seen they beat somebody up. That's the part of the whole culture of cover up and lying that I think goes too unexamined. The negative impact it has in this essential connection to the community in terms of trust. Now I know. And a lot's been done under the new Commissioner Evans about, you know, bringing back community policing and addressing these issues of trust and all that. And I just hope it's true. I don't know, because I've heard, you know, if you've been at the Globe, those kinds of things have been reported before. And it takes a special kind of reporting into the community to get a sense of whether that big divide has closed in some ways.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and just going back, circling back to sort of like the advance of the Black Lives Power movement, is that, you know, people are able to sort of, in a way, take away the middleman and sort of report on their own stories in
sure.
a way, because those, how else do they get their stories out there? And, you know, in some ways, some of those movements, they can have an adversarial role with the media. I'm thinking also of like the Occupy movement had a mm-hmm. really adversarial role with the media. And I was just sort of wondering, you know, of if you could sort of comment on how, as journalists, you can follow up and sort of go deeper into those stories. Like if those stories, when we see people taking video on their cell phone and those videos go viral and they get to people and they create outrage, how then that can sort of spark, you know, investigative work at, say, the Globe or
right.
elsewhere.
Well, yeah, I'm a cockeyed optimist about all that. I really am. I'm excited about the opportunity that everyone has sort of, you know, a camera in their pocket. And mm-hmm. We can collate and we can collect those, you know, those documents, those video documents that they're creating, and then do the real work that we do. You know, if you look, if any of you are familiar with the Marshall Project, where they're doing some amazing, the former editor of the New York Times, you know, goes online and creates this thing out of nothing, focusing on criminal justice issues. And so videos like that can lead to some amazing depth reporting by the professionals, by folks like us. I think those are completely complementary. I'm not concerned about the existence of those if we still continue to do our jobs.
Yeah.
If the Marshall Project takes a Beth Schwartzapfel, a wonderful reporter, and looks at those and sort of sees the trend lines and sees what, you know, what's happening and puts it together into a really thoughtful piece, we all benefit. So
right.
I think it's a positive development.
Yeah. And I also wanted just to touch on this because I think that something a lot of, like this, you know, Spotlight, everyone across the country knows about Spotlight because Spotlight was the name of the, you know, Best Picture winner a year
ago. Who saw the movie?
Anyone here see the movie?
Oh, right.
All right,
good.
Yes. And,
if you
know,
didn't, you can leave.
The last time we had a movie of that high of prominence that with journalism at its center was All the President's Men, you know, in the 1970s. It was a very different culture then. We have a much more crowded media landscape now. The state of, you know, of newspapers, the state of journalism schools is very different today than it was then. And, you know, here, this movie was sort of making heroes out of people who were digging around in dusty archives and doing sort of the hard work of investigative work. And I'm just sort of wondering if you know, if you've seen any, like, Spotlight effect in terms of, both of you teach at Boston University, you're working with the young journalists of tomorrow, and you're also, you know, obviously continuing to work with the Globe. If you're kind of seeing this sort of increased interest in investing in journalism and an increased interest from young people in entering the field.
Well, I don't think we have any data yet, but in our world in the past year and after the success of the movie, it's certainly charged a lot of people up. It's charged us up. It's charged the students we work with. It's charged up the new students who have come in this year, and I think rightfully so. I mean, there's a movie that, on the one hand, as you said, Alicia, it shows that, you know, long-term investigative reporting is very unglamorous in many ways. It's a grind,
yeah.
And yet the impact and the value of that work. Was beautiful. It was beautifully put together in that drama on the screen. So, and what a difference journalism can make in America. I mean, that was a great message, and that was the kind of thing that inspires and motivates all of us on a day to day. But there it was on the big screen. So it's a real inspiration.
I'm much too young to remember All the President's Men. No, we're both children of that era. We're both, you know, we saw a huge number of people say, yeah, journalism, that's meaningful.
Yeah.
And again, it's still just anecdotal, but no question. We're seeing our students thriving. You know, we had a showing of Spotlight, and you'd think we were giving away free beer.
Wow.
You know, they overflowed our Comm 101, our largest hall. And they're excited about it. And again, you know, we said this to our other colleagues. The best part is that it was shown as an unglamorous, mm-hmm. You know, profession where the Mike Resendiz character, Mark Ruffalo, is living, you know, in sort of a basement apartment. You know, and Ben Bradley shows up with a pizza, and you know, Ben's an old friend of ours. So is Michael. And I'm like, that's Hollywood. Ben never showed up with a pizza. but if that's the limit of the glamorization, we can work on it. We're okay.
thank you. So, and you know, and there we're looking at sort of the journalist as hero in that movie. But I feel like I have to return to this now because there's so much that's sort of on my mind about this this unique election in terms of sort of journalism under attack and the vilification of journalists by a certain Republican candidate. But you know, also there's a really unusual thing happening where this, like CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists, the chairman produced an unprecedented letter earlier this week saying that Donald Trump was actually a threat to press freedom. You have newspapers like the Washington Globe in some ways jettisoning, or some people would argue, their objectivity in reporting on Trump. And you have newspapers and publications like The Atlantic and USA Today coming out in favor of Hillary or against Trump, who have never taken a stand in previous elections. And I just sort of wondered if you could sort of comment on, like, on some ways I feel like journalists are under fire, but in other ways I feel like we're seeing the value of journalists being able to report, you know, at these rallies, or journalists being able to dig into these accusations that have just been coming out every single day. I can barely keep track against Donald Trump. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Sure. You mind if I'll start. Again, I see two sides of the coin. I think we're seeing some of the best investigative reporting, best sort of digging in reporting that we've seen during a presidential election in my lifetime. David Farenthold of the Washington Post, his work on the Trump charities, his work on the Trump Foundation, has been remarkable. Sort of old-fashioned shoe leather reporting that has absolutely moved the needle. And certainly the New York Times, Suzanne Craig, doing the work when she was leaked, the taxes.
Right. That was incredible.
Really brave work being done. And then this new threat by Donald Trump to sue the Times for libel because they reported on these two women who came forward and said basically what Donald Trump said he did, he actually did. And he said, that's a lie, but he said it. I don't really understand. I'm confused. And the Times saying, and if you got to read the Times lawyer publicly sort of went public with this letter responding to Donald Trump's threat of a lawsuit. And it's this great letter that can be basically reduced to bring it on, bro. It's just this robust answer. And so we have two things going on. We have great journalism happening in the midst of this campaign, and we also have a tremendous number of threats. Female reporters feeling threatened, particularly. A number of them have been writing about it in the last few days, feeling a need to remove their credentials when they're leaving the stage or
and
leaving
sometimes
the press
they're booed at rallies. The press comes in after the attendees at rallies, and they'll be booed and given the middle finger by people. Like there's open hostility against the press.
At the direction of the candidate. Mm-hmm. I mean, the candidate is stopping in the middle of his speeches and saying, and tell those people to stop lying, and tell those people to turn their cameras on you, and show the crowds. And he has made the press a foil, and I think that's a really dangerous trend.
Yeah, and I was questioned too about like the aftermath, even, or if you think about it, like he's so much of his recent attacks have been sort of on the legitimacy of democracy and on the legitimacy of the press, and saying that, like, I think in South Carolina yesterday he said that the election will be rigged because of the role of the press, like that somehow the press is crooked and that we shouldn't trust outlets like the New York Times, you know, that they are against him. And I'm wondering, you know, if there's a significant proportion of the population that will just stop believing in, stop reading, you know, what we consider to, you know, that we, the press is so much about objectivity and we trust the New York Times to be objective, but like how the effects of his undermining might be, if you don't have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really dark, and it's hard to imagine where that will go. It's clear that there's threats right now to a lot of our freedoms, not just the press, but certainly one that concerns me the most is the threat to press freedom, because the Republican candidate, he doesn't really understand, I don't think, democracy, and he certainly doesn't seem to understand the First Amendment. And thank goodness we have that First Amendment, the constitutional protection that gives us the ability in journalism to play the watchdog role. And a lot of countries, most countries, don't have anything like it. But I don't think the First Amendment's going to go anywhere. And so just as the New York Times attorney in that wonderful letter that Mitch referred to basically said, bring it on, he's inviting him. If you have no clue, Mr. Candidate, bring it to court, bring your libel claim to court, and we'll have a judge teach you what it means to have a First Amendment and have First Amendment protections against libel that, you know, gives us the freedom. I mean, this is one of the beauties of the First Amendment and the Supreme Court's rulings in libel. It gives the press the freedoms to make mistakes because we're not, the press isn't, you know, isn't perfect. And the imposition of the high bar, the bar that there has, someone has to, you know, show fault, that there was either negligence or reckless disregard. It's got to be more than a mistake. You know, in the common law back in England stuff, all you had to prove was that there was a mistake in the paper. Something was false, and you're on your way to winning a libel claim. But, you know, the First Amendment and the interpretation of it has given us, you know, the ability of the running room to do the important kind of work we do. And we try to verify, you know, and verify again before we go public and publish something that's revelatory. But there will be times when there's a mistake. But unless that party can show that there was malice behind it all, that there's some level of fault, we're still protected. And that's crucial.
You know, I just add, when I started in this business, you know, I'm feeling a lot of love in this room. Thank you. But when we started in this business...
They haven't asked questions yet.
That's true. That's a good point. I take that back. When I started in this business, I remember there was a Time magazine piece that pointed out that journalists were held in lower regard than Congress. Now, think about that a minute. And that it was a concern. I remember my parents sort of saying, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And so we've always faced you know, that issue. What does trouble me is that there has in this particular cycle been a demonization at a level that I've never seen. With threats of violence.
Yeah, and encouragement. You know,
yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Take action against
them. Yeah, right. And reporters being assailed on Twitter with like deeply anti-Semitic, very revolting and threatening imagery.
Yes, and again, I in my experience, more has been directed at female journalists in this current cycle, where the threats are incredibly personal, incredibly violent, incredibly vicious, suggesting what they'd like to see happen to them.
That's horrible.
And a number of female journalists in particular have pointed this out and started to talk about it. And I think that's going to be sort of our big postmortem of the campaign, is trying to assess how much damage to the Fourth Estate we've suffered.
Right, but I think on some levels, and we don't really know, you know, we've been in such a position of having to defend what the First Amendment means and the value of having journalists covering these events, that in a way it gets us to sort of appreciate what it's about, like to, you know, we can't take it for granted, and that's sort of maybe a silver lining if there can be to any of this.
Another thing that, you know, in terms of in this kind of environment, I mean, I think there's never has the training of journalists in this environment has never been more important and essential, because not only because of the challenges in this environment we've been talking about, but also the fact that everything's changed with the internet and the shuttering of and the diminution of print newspapers and all that, and there's so much information just comes flying in and out from everywhere, that to have a profession, to have journalists, you know, who are trained, whether on the job, you know, Mitch and I, we both didn't come up through any kind of journalism program. We learned on the job, you know, in the business. But we're not to be, you know, swayed or moved by if someone's screaming in your face, but to stay the course and to stay on the story and not believe everything you hear at first time, even if it sounds great, even if someone's telling you something that if it's true, it's a page one story, and everyone always likes to get a page one story or a lead story on the TV news, but you just don't run with it without, you know, putting it through the mill that we learn in journalism, to testing it, to verifying, to be fair about it. And part of the testing is to whoever the story may be about, is to make sure you don't publish without, being in touch and getting that person's perspective on it. and blending it into the piece. I mean the value of journalism
education
I think is huge.
Well, yeah, I mean, that, just looking at, you know, you've both been working decades in the field, and so much has changed in terms of the digital landscape and people being able to, you know, what makes someone a journalist today? Like, do you call someone a journalist if they're, you know, reporting, tweeting live from a site? If they're blogging, like, they don't have to go through the same credentials necessarily. And certainly, you know, in a separate whole topic is the difficulty of even making a living as a journalist today versus 15 or 20 years ago, especially if you are on that firing line of people threatening you and you're like, why am I doing this? Like, I'm putting myself in the, but I'm wondering, you know, if you could just sort of comment on, you know, how the sort of free availability of people to report and to sort of make a dent without having that training can negatively impact the sort of reputation of journalists in the media.
It's a real danger. But, you know, we judge you by your work. And it's always been the nature of journalism, that there are no licenses to become a journalist, and there never have been and never should be. So if someone declares herself a journalist and goes out and live tweets an event and does so accurately and fairly, that's a form of journalism. And I think we should embrace that. At the same time, we need to defend the values and the principles that we came up with and that we believe in, and try to, I guess, try to inculcate them into the citizen journalists who are out there, who are not, because, let's face it, because of technology, because of a lot of other things, manipulation is easier than ever.
What do you mean when you say manipulation?
Well, the digital manipulation, if you make a photo look a little bit differently, now it's easier than ever. You can manipulate by hiding behind a name that isn't yours. You can, you know, I think there are a lot of different ways. There's even manipulation there. I mean, there are people who pass themselves off as authors who claim to write nonfiction who fictionalize dialogue and fictionalize stories. And we're purists. We're old school. And so I think, I'm not sure I'm answering your question fully, but I guess... as much as anything, I just want to see us hold up those standards. And again, it really goes back to what Dick was saying about education, about journalism education, the value of what we teach, the value of what we do at a standard that has been set. And I think that's our only hope.
Yeah, I think that's a very strong point. I mean, I think there's also a challenge in that there's a pressure in the environment to get stories out as quickly as possible and to get the, you know, certainly the long investigative work that you're doing takes months and months, and that's sort of the work that can actually, you know, change the tide of how local government and local police systems work, and that's very important. But, you know, you also have a system where, you know, people are under pressure to put up fabulous stories who maybe don't have that training, and how do they get that training if they don't go into, you know, a journalism program?
Yeah.
I am going to want to start opening up the discussion for questions from the audience. I've got so many. Ma'am.
I wonder if you might share with us.
I'm going to pass out a microphone to you.
Thank you. I wonder if you might share with us what the internal or external dialogue is like for you in checking your own biases when you are presenting work.
That's a great question.
Good question. Thank
it
you.
It is good. I think in a general sense, the process is, like, so you get a piece of information, there might be an emotional, there might be a response to it in the sense that you've been working on a project for a while, and this piece of information adds to the critical mass that you've been developing. It's going to even make the story elevating even bigger, okay? And so there might be a feeling of excitement about that. But I think the training comes in is you try to check that. And sometimes that's why being on a team is helpful.
Hmm.
Because, you know, one of us, Mitch, he would always come running in with thinking he's got the best thing he's ever found, and we said, calm down.
I was a golden retriever. Yeah. Picture a golden retriever.
No. But whether it's internal or, you know, a colleague, you know, as a member of a team, you try to check that, And just learn to test the information. And that's the, you know, we call it the principle of verification. How do we know this is true? This person says it's true. Has this person ever been a reliable source in the past? You know, there might be that analysis. Oh, yeah, this is my police source at the Boston PD that's been a source for 10 years. His batting average is like 1,000. So that starts putting me on track to believing this that he's told me. Or is this a first-time source? I've never talked to this person before. The stuff he or she's telling me is unbelievable. But wait, I'm going to have to work even harder than I might have with source A to come to think that it's to the point where it's publishable. So you go through, and every case can be different, but you need to test it. And then you need to accept the fact that if you start to test it and it starts to slip and it's not as good as it was first presented, you got to accept that. And not try to rationalize, cover, you know, see it in a way. No, I still want it to be true because it's better for the story. I hope that answers your question. But that's sort of the process we do.
I would just add briefly, it's a real concern of mine because when you were in, we both came up through the culture of the Globe and the culture of an organization, and the culture was story first, that you know. The value of the story more than the value of what it might do. It might move the election this way, or it might. The effect has to always be secondary. We talked about being on the four corners of the page, that you don't focus on what your bias is, or you know, you have to be true to the story wherever it leads, and sort of checking each other and having that kind of internal and external dialogue. If anybody violated it, if anybody was clearly in favor of one thing happening, of an outcome, they would be checked by the system that, hey, this person no longer can play the umpire and call balls and strikes impartially because they're rooting for one team or the other. And you'd be taken out. You'd be taken out of the spotlight team, or you'd be taken out of that story by the culture. And so my one concern about the fractured nature of the business right now is that we potentially will lose that if everybody's operating independently as a journalist just in his or her own basement. That's a concern.
That's a good point. Thank you. Yes, this gentleman right here.
First of all, let me say this has been extremely stimulating in many ways.
Thank you.
A general comment, observation, not criticism. What we've heard today could, from a certain perspective, be considered an anti-Trump political event, not simply a panel. Mm-hmm. Just making a comment. Now, mm-hmm. My question is an A and B question, and it's a difficult one. Have there ever been, and we're in a church, perhaps confession is appropriate. I'm curious if either of you has ever had the experience of feeling, I'm not sure about what I'm about to write. I've checked as thoroughly as I can, but I am not sure. I know it could have tremendous effect politically, socially, whatever. Have you had that experience? And if so, what have you done about it? Have you published anyway? Have you decided I'm going to back out of the story? I've just don't know how to be fair and ethical about this. That's question one, AA. And question related obliquely, number two. We tend, I think, to see in the newspaper very often major and popular events, or events discussed that would attract the attention of many people. But so much, I think, happens, and I wonder if you agree, in institutions particularly, that are minor events but ethically maybe more important than the major events. Does our media cover those adequately in your view?
Those are two very different questions.
Yes. I didn't know there'd be math. I'll take the first one because it was more direct to me. Yes, absolutely. I've known the feeling. We had an editor named Jerry O'Neill who was our first, my editor at Spotlight. And Jerry had a phrase, he would say, write scared. He wanted us to push up to the limits of our reporting to sort of say, how far can you go and still be within the bounds of accuracy, of truth, of fairness, of balance, et cetera, all the values of journalism. But when you're doing that, you are scared. You are absolutely sweating it out that I'm pushing right up to this edge. And so, yes, I've definitely written scared. I've never published scared, though. That's the difference. Because, again, inside a good system, inside with editors, with colleagues like Dick, where I would we would pass story versions back and forth to each other, and really, we would grill each other more than any lawyer or any outside person ever could imagine, because we knew the inside of the story. And so it's a verification process. It's a discipline of verification that by the time you publish, you're enormously comfortable. And then there are copy editors, and there's enough layers to make you feel better.
So yeah, you want a piece to be as hard-hitting as possible, yeah. And that's why we would be encouraged, and that's what the editor would pull us back from the cliff to write scared. But then we would argue. It said, what you've written is you're overreaching. You're reaching beyond what we know.
It could be an adjective.
What we've proven, what evidence we have to support the point of view that this Spotlight Project is taking, that priests abuse kids, okay? Whatever it might be. So overreach was like the thing is like that the landmine that you didn't want to do. Let the evidence, let the reporting speak for itself, but not overreach. I don't think I've had the experience of publishing scared, as Mitch called it. I have certainly screwed up, and after publication learned that wording and on a big stage too, a big investigative piece or something, wording that I thought was airtight actually created the wrong impression about something, and it wasn't like perhaps technically inaccurate. But it was more an impression that general readers would have, and that would drive me insane. That goes to the training. I wouldn't sleep if this happens too. If we misspell someone's name in the paper, forget about the rest of the sleep for the rest of the week. I mean, that's how we try to drill our students, is that this stuff really matters, and you kind of develop this sort of conscience in your head. So that you go crazy if you do screw up because you're only human despite your best efforts, or if you think like, oh my God, if I were just to make up a quote here, it would be so perfect in the narrative or something, that something starts going crazy in your head, or like the third rail on the subway line, it's an electric shock or something.
I'll give a quick response to part B. I would say, first of all, I'm always hesitant to talk about the media because there is no monolith, there is no media. It's a glass on the floor, it fractures into a million pieces. That's the media. But there's no doubt that you're onto something, and we're constantly doing postmortems and saying we emphasized the wrong thing. What was the story we missed? Did we swing the pendulum too far this way because everybody was running in that direction? And not to make it about us in this case, but we always trained ourselves to look at when everybody's on this side of the boat and it's tipping this way, what's the zag? If everybody's zigging, what's the zag?
That's
what's the other
point.
Story that's uncovered? And I think there are a lot, I think that's happening more and more because we have more news organizations than ever. The beauty of the internet is that it has let a thousand flowers bloom. So there are very few untold stories. Now we just have to rebalance the emphasis to get it back to center.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The woman in the T-shirt, Antiques in Africa, I think.
Oh.
Hi. I'm Des. So I'm thinking about the role of the citizen journalist, thinking how that converges with the role of the citizen archivist and a lot of the really amazing work that's being done around community-driven archives, particularly in documenting police violence, like the People's Archive of Police Violence in Cleveland, and there's also online archives with Ferguson and Baltimore. So my question is, what is the role of the journalist in supporting this self-documentation that's already happening in these communities and working with, the possibilities of working with archivists and people who are already involved in communities to publicize these stories that are already happening and are, like, there's already a narrative there, how can journalists work with archivists and other allied professions to not only nurture those relationships with communities, but to also bring to light these stories of systemic racism, of systemic transphobia, and things like that.
I think it's a tremendous resource, as a potential place to go if you're, say, if there's something equivalent to that here in Boston's neighborhoods, and if you're working on a story and you know that there's a group doing that kind of work, that's a place to go and check out, check what they have. Again, it doesn't mean you just accept it without, you know, again, testing it, or but there might be, you know, material, raw material there for which you can build on for your story. Or you network through that organization to people that you need to find in order to pursue your story. So I would look at it, you know, that's my first response when you were talking and describing that was, oh, what a great potential resource to go to.
Those kinds of alliances need to happen, and it would be a shame not to see them happen. I tend to think that it's almost, I want to turn to the community archivist, the citizen archivist, to urge them to reach out to the journalists and let them know we're out here.
Look what we have.
You guys are supposedly reporting about police issues, but we have documented every arrest in Area B of Boston, and you haven't done that. And shame on the journalists for not finding the citizen archivist, but it can be a two-way street. And I'd love, and frankly, just speaking personally, if we can help make that happen here in Boston, reach out to us. We will make those introductions to the journalists we know at the Globe and other places.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. So you guys mentioned the full frontal assault on liberal media or establishment media from like Sarah Palin through to Alex Jones. But there's fertile ground there that they're sowing this distrust into. And it seems like there are economic and demographic shifts that are making people feel alienated. And mm-hmm. those seem like bigger issues to me. Where do you think the main problem in rebuilding trust with those communities lies? And or what is an approach to start solving
to rebuilding trust?
I want to make sure I understand your question.
I didn't follow.
Yeah, you're suggesting, am I correct? You're suggesting that the folks on the right who are tearing down the what they like to call the mainstream media, what is your point about them? I want to make sure I'm clear.
That there's a large part of the population that feels like it's being left behind. You know, like white Protestants are a shrinking percentage of the population. They don't think the economic recovery are at the levels that they've seen before, and yet they're being told the economy is okay. Barack Obama's out there every day saying it's great.
I think I understand. And I don't know if you're going to like my answer, but my answer is fairly simple. I'm not terribly worried about them in the sense that I'm worried about them the way I'm worried about all Americans and everybody, our entire audience. But I don't think the media is doing its job if it responds to things that aren't rational. If we are doing systematic data reporting and we're finding that the economic recovery is not as deep as the president or the Bureau of Labor Statistics or anybody else says, we need to report that. And because if we're constantly chasing an audience, we will go to the lowest common denominator. We need to be chasing the truth. We need to be chasing the story. So I think you're onto a real issue. But the only way we're going to maintain our credibility with that clientele or that audience is by telling stories fairly and honestly. I don't care if it's President Obama or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Paul Ryan, if they're making a claim and we're not checking it, that you know, then we have no reason to exist. Then we have we've abdicated our responsibility. My hope is that the audience will find us, and we'll find that whoever is telling them what they want to hear is really just selling them snake oil. That whether they call it the mainstream media or the liberal media or whatever, there's truth underneath these stories, and there's evidence underneath these stories rather than just the claims.
Thank you. Right there, ma'am.
Very succinct. What do you feel about the police officers wearing cameras?
Oh, yes. 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 Oh, definitely. Yeah. How about wearing their name tags?
Yeah, in Boston. You brought that the other day.
One of the things that always drove me nuts when I was at the Globe is that the police department in Boston, they don't wear name tags. They do in my community where I live outside of Boston. Everywhere they did in Hartford, where I used to, you know, report. For some reason, it became the long-standing tradition or something. And I was happy to read in the last couple of weeks that Commissioner Evans is moving and wants his officers. That sends a small but important message that they don't wear them. The cameras, the name bags, yes. And, you know, we want them to do their job to the best of their abilities, you know, behind them. But, boy, those small but important things like a name tag, I think, puts distance between us, the people and the police.
Although the absence of, yeah.
The absence of, yeah.
That material is bubbling up to you already.
Absolutely,
it doesn't get lost. It's but the material that is on there that they videotape. Cameras bubbles up to you.
Guys. It will, yeah. Yeah, but obviously in other events in other places, it's certainly become part of the coverage.
Yeah,
we're
envious of the reporters in Chicago or in Baltimore, where that becomes part of the story, and we need to see it here. And frankly, there was a police shooting a number of months ago where there was a video that was captured. I think it was just sort of CCD, and it was great because it showed that the shoot was completely justified, that this guy was firing, was armed, and was attacking these cops. And you're not even hearing about that story because it actually helped the police officers who had a justified shoot that day.
Cuts both ways, obviously.
Yeah. Any questions, ma'am? I'm just pointing at you.
I'm curious, how do you expect us not to believe that media is biased if reports like, Trump sent 240 times his plane to save American Marines, or NBC publishes a poll that Hillary is ahead by 11 points that was made by Hillary's campaign, and on and on and on. Facts are never published widely. When they find illegitimate son of Bill Clinton, main media does not even touch it. How do you expect, after all those facts, for us to say it's a fair media?
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to convince you. I would just say simply, there are examples where the media mistakes, where media, are not living up to the standards that we set for them. But
it's a question of omissions of huge facts.
Of what?
Omission of huge facts?
Facts that never gets published. Anytime it's against Hillary, it just gets ignored. The media attacks the fact that the women who were raped by Clinton were in an audience.
I'll just say, I'm...
You're not going to convince her.
We don't agree with you.
I
mean, if we weighed the material, the investigative material against that would some people would say is against Hillary Clinton, it would fill this room. There's been tremendous amounts of reporting on Hillary Clinton on the nine Benghazi investigations, which I've written about Benghazi, about her emails, about there's. I think there's more balance. If you really honestly look at it, if you step out of whatever feelings you have towards her or towards any candidate, and you really look at the job collectively, the media, if we want to put it that way, has done, there's tremendous amounts of reporting on both sides of the aisle.
And there's no way I could imagine the Globe sitting on a story of facts that they've verified. Yeah. That might be anti-Hillary Clinton or anti-Kennedy.
I want to move on to some other questions here. Ma'am, I think we got a mic coming over to you.
Journalists and educators and religious leaders should be objective. And the problem, as I see it, is when you try to be objective and you're facing groups and you really feel it's really an important in taking a moral stand in the face of what you perceive to be great evil, what do you do about that? That's my moral question of the week.
Go.
I would just say simply, we don't actually talk a lot about being objective. We talk about being impartial. We talk about exercising the discipline of our craft the same way, again, to use the metaphor of the umpire, that it's more important to us to maintain the standards of our profession and drop out and by discipline and by effort and by study to drop out our feelings. Now, if they reach a point where morally, and obviously we can think of historical examples where there comes a point, I believe that I would step out and stop doing the job of the journalist. If I felt as though only my voice was essential to add to this chorus. But if the chorus is already singing and I can do my job by impartially reporting what song they're singing, that's my role in society. There's a moral value to that as well that I will uphold.
Thank you. Do we have one last question? Okay. The gentleman in the plaid shirt.
There's fewer dollars for investigative reporting, especially at the state and local level. What's your thought about using federal dollars to fund investigative reporting? Do you think that doing so would undermine journalists' ability to play the watchdog role?
The moment you said federal dollars, finance, I might, no.
We're out.
We're out. It just, no. It can't have strings like that attached to what we do. We have to, we have to find, new revenue streams on our own for both local, national, and foundation money. I mean, Mitch mentioned the Marshall Project, which is a terrific standalone journalistic project that's drawn a lot of talent. It was unnecessary and unthinkable 20 years ago to have something like that, but it's a response to the changing landscape.
Thank you very much. We are going to conclude this session. Thank you so much to Dick Lair and Mitch Zukov for their generosity. We're going to be signing books downstairs on the first floor. We're going to be signing. We have copies of Black Mass and 13 Hours, the What Happened in Benghazi, which is Mitch Zukov's book. So please stick around. Go downstairs. Thank you so much.